Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives, so please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
If we lose this cultural war, we're going to have a hedonistic, humanistic society.
Discover the story of the culture warrior, Don Wildman, and how he went head-to-head with Hollywood, Playboy, the homosexual agenda, and the Disney empire. The movement Don started paved the way for Christians to boldly stand for truth and righteousness in a hostile culture. Watch Culture Warrior today for free. Visit culturewarrior.movie.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Tuesday, April 22nd, and a lot going on at the Supreme Court this week, including today. Oral arguments will be in Maumud v. Taylor. The issue here is whether public schools burden parents' religious exercise when they compel elementary school children to participate in instruction on gender and sexuality against their parents' religious convictions and without notice or opportunity to opt out. So a lot of these more leftist LGBTQ issues going up to the Supreme Court. It'll be interesting to see what the decision is and the oral argument today. Let's welcome in Ron Coleman, who is an attorney and host of the Coleman Nation podcast. You can also follow him on X, and I will remind listeners that he is even more snarky than I am on X, so you have been duly warned and we're giving you notice on that one. But good morning, my friend, and this is a very interesting case.
It certainly is, and it's interesting for a couple of reasons.
And let's get into those.
Well, one, of course, is the obvious issue that you mentioned, that there's this gross violation, not only of decency and fundamental morality, but of the parents' rights to educate their children as they see fit, and to provide, you know, and not have their moral teaching at home undermined in such an obvious way. And this is something that the Supreme Court, I think, is going to have to reckon with, and they have difficulty doing so since they have, in unfortunately, much of their previous jurisprudence over the last 10 or 15 years, essentially taking the position that the sort of things being taught to the Mahmoud children is of no moral consequence whatsoever. But what is interesting is that the parents, I believe, are Muslims.
Mm.
And this reminds me of a case I was involved in where the Supreme Court had the ability to make a ruling that was not politically incorrect, but which would have been politically incorrect if the issue were the same, but the parties were a little bit different. These are not Christian parents.
Hmm.
By virtue of having Muslim parents, I think the Supreme Court may believe that they can sort of get away with making a ruling vindicating the parents' rights.
That's really fascinating and probably accurate, unfortunately, with the composition of the court, because if these were Christian parents, then it would be a lot easier for the left to simply point that out. But is this couched basically as a First Amendment issue squarely, or is this more in line with the precedent of parents' rights? And how do we get around the fact that, I mean, any instruction in school, if there is a position taken on an issue, can run afoul of parents' religious exercise, at least in some way. So where would be the bright line rule from the Supreme Court. I mean, when we're talking about gender and sexuality, there's kind of an obvious bright line. But when you're talking about just instruction that runs afoul of parents' religious beliefs and free exercise, then that can get messy really quickly.
It certainly can, and I don't think we're going to get a bright line, not from this court, and not in this era. And I'm grateful that they're at least taking the case on, because obviously they're going to have to draw a line somewhere, which is something that this court has been really, really bad about. Harmeet Dhillon, who you and I both know, and who finally and belatedly ascended to her role as Deputy Attorney General for Civil Rights, just tweeted last week that there's a parents' rights issue. You're right. And the Supreme Court has recognized that parents have a right. The question is, as you observe, it's not really easy to know where those lines go. I mean, there are parents, after all, who believe some of the wackiest things in the world. There are parents who believe that their children should be turned into the opposite sex of how they were born. There are children who believe that their children should be wearing masks. There's all kinds of lunacy out there. It is very hard to see how the Supreme Court is going to rule on this, although it has to, thank God, without actually defining where. Let me take a step back. As you know, courts under the First Amendment will never, quote, never get involved in the sincerity of religious beliefs or substance of religious beliefs. But we live in a country now where the mentality of other countries, including concepts like honor killings of one's own children who are guilty of, for example, being raped, or who are guilty of, and that was guilty with scare quotes, or guilty of not being good Muslims, as the case may be, we don't have that in our culture. It's not part of Judaism. It's not part of Christianity. It's part of Islam. Obviously, there are limits to what we parents are. Children are not extensions of parents. They're not property of parents. There is a constitutional right for parents to raise their own children, but it's going to be very interesting to see how the Supreme Court frames the issue here and deals with it. I certainly hope they deal with it the right way. I can't imagine they took the case up here in order to rule that parents have no say in the matter.
Right. I would agree with you on that. I'm speaking with Ron Coleman, who is an attorney and host of the Coleman Nation podcast. And I think it's pretty clear that this is going to be in favor of parents. And then the obvious question, though, beyond the bright line is whether this will end up, in a sense, bad precedent when we're talking just about publicly funded institutions, public schools. I mean, this isn't a Christian school or a private school that parents can choose and they send their kids to. And so then, you know, opt out in that sense. But will this be problematic at all if there is a finding of burdening parents' religious exercise in this sense, that it goes then more to the issue of separation of church and state and tries to get the publicly funded institutions to not teach any type of morality, any type of worldview? And that's where I could see the left wing of the court wanting to say, you know, listen, if we're saying this is burdening parents' religious exercise, then what we define as religion taught in schools is very broad, and we need to excise all of that. And so we end up actually strengthening the myth of separation of church and state in a way that perhaps the right wing of the court isn't intending.
It's a great question. I just don't see how they square this circle here without making some very substantial judgment calls, which, guess what? guys. That's your job.
That was a direct shot at Chief Justice Roberts, by the way, when Ron says that, for sure, because he always has the problem standing up firmly, for sure. And so it's going to be interesting, though, to see what the line of questioning is. And that's why I always like listening to the oral arguments, especially because we can do that live now. We used to not be able to do that. It used to be like every Friday they would release the audio, which was even new from other history. But overall, if you're on the court, Ron, which, you know, you should be, in my opinion, but whatever. we'll tell Hermeet to tell Trump that, right?
Friend,
I know, right? Yes, of course. But we'll tell Hermeet to get there. But if you're on the court, where should the line be in a case like this?
If it were I would say that it has always been part of education, that it's inevitably part of any education, that moral frameworks be part of what children are taught. It is a little unrealistic and even really subversive to suggest that it's possible to just convey information and skills without recognizing that there is a moral framework in which children operate in the world. Parents and teachers are not the same thing, but you can't ignore the fact, and it would really be, again, I think, subversive to suggest that you ignore the fact that children have to be taught not to steal, not to cheat. We can't even suggest that merely the Ten Commandments be the baseline, because that involves things like recognizing the existence of God and not having any other God before me. What are we going to do with our Hindu children? And observing the Sabbath. So, okay, that's out. But we can say that matters of sexuality are probably best left entirely to children's family and moral teaching. And no, we're not going to outlaw sex education. You're asking Ron Coleman, would he outlaw sex education in school? Ron Coleman would, actually. But in order for me to get the majority I need to support the opinion that I'm going to assign to myself as Chief Justice. You're not just going to put me on the Supreme Court. I have to be Chief Justice.
Okay. Jenna. All right. Duly noted for the record, counsel. Okay.
So if it's going to be my opinion, in order for me to get the consensus that I need, I'll say, no, we're not talking about something like sex education for adolescents, which is not before the court at this time. Let's put it that way. But there's no reason that young children should be involved in any education that implicates sexuality. It's simply age appropriate, and it's for that. That's a call that is entirely for parents to make.
And I think that's a reasonable way to draw out the issue and to say, okay, we're going to specifically only focus on the issues of gender and sexuality, and that should remain for the parents in the home and not necessarily broach any of the other instruction that may be provided by an institution, which of course is, when we think of a school traditionally, we don't think of sex education, we don't think of gender theory, we don't think of, you know, all of these other sort of indoctrination that the left is trying to bring through these secular institutions and using public funding and all of that. We think of the traditional curriculum, like teach them how to read and write and your basic instruction and the subject matter that you learn in school, not all of these other ancillary things. And so perhaps the court can at least draw a distinction there that a lot of these types of subject matter are best left for the individual parents and their persuasion, whether it's on religion or not. It doesn't necessarily have to be particularly faith-based or not. It's just inappropriate for a public institution to indoctrinate children or to have that type of topic in school. So it'll be interesting, and we're already out of time for this segment, but the oral arguments are today at 10 a.m. Eastern. You can always go to the Supreme Court blog, or I actually prefer C-SPAN, because if you watch that online, then you can see which justice is speaking, because sometimes it's not always clear exactly which counsel and which justice is speaking. But if you're interested in listening to that, and I know we'll also have coverage on American Family News of this case. But Ron Coleman, thanks so much for, I should say Chief Justice Ron Coleman, at least here. Thanks so much for your commentary this morning. You can also follow him on X, and we will be right back with more.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, yesterday, Harvard University sued the Trump administration over its efforts to pull $2.2 billion in federal funding after the school said it would not comply with the administration's demands over its handling of anti-Semitism. This is coming from Just the News. They report the move comes after President Donald Trump recommended that the Internal Revenue Service rescind the school's tax-exempt status last week over the school's refusal to comply. The demands include merit-based hiring, reforming programs with a history of anti-Semitism, and getting rid of diversity, equity, and inclusion policies. Harvard President Alan Garber accused the federal government of attempting to exert, quote, unprecedented and improper control over the school, and said the freeze impacts programs unrelated to anti-Semitism, including the school's research on cancer, the spread of infectious disease outbreaks — they were probably really helpful during COVID, right? — and reducing the risk of diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So Mike Donnelly is a constitutional law professor and attorney and frequent guest of the program. So Mike, it always seems that places like Harvard, it's like, oh, no, this isn't about anything that Donald Trump is recommending that the IRS actually look at. We're going to go to, you're stopping our research on cancer. How dare you? Very leftist. So what's actually going on here, and what do we anticipate from this lawsuit?
This is a very interesting case, Jenna. The administration sent a letter to Harvard, and I haven't been able to actually read the full letter. I have, however, read the entire complaint that Harvard filed. They're essentially saying that the letter, by freezing the grants, which had been issued by a variety of agencies, violates the First Amendment, free speech, and also the Administrative Procedures Act. So that's basically what Harvard is complaining about. They're saying that, hey, look, you're not following the proper procedure to terminate these grants. And, you're trying to tell us who we should hire, what we should teach, these kinds of things. So it's a detailed complaint. People can find it online and read about it. Jenna, a lot of this comes back to me, to the issue of the size of the federal government. It's too big. The founders never intended for the federal government to give $60 billion a year to universities. This started back in World War II when the government started using universities to fund weapons research mostly, and it has expanded now, especially into the health area. Over half of all research funding is in the area of health. And you mentioned the COVID issue. I mean, yes, Anthony mm-hmm. Fauci's research was federally funded, and it caused pandemic. Okay, we can trace the cause of the pandemic to our federal government funding virology labs in China to explore gain-of-function research in coronaviruses, right? So this is what happens when the federal government gets too big, too powerful. You can't track all of this. People use the money for their own political agenda, and that's what Harvard has done, along with other universities. So is there a problem with wokeism and DEI and a failure of universities to protect Jewish students, which is one of the complaints the administration has against some of these universities? I think there is. What do we do about it? Do universities have a right to this funding? No, they don't. But when the government gives them that funding, are they able to just yank it at a moment's notice? That's what the complaint that Harvard has against the government is that, hey, look, there are procedures you have to follow, and you can't just freeze funding. You've got to go through certain procedures, including giving us notice, telling us there's a problem, informal working things out, and then formal action. So that's kind of what's going on with this lawsuit.
That's interesting. And that the procedural aspect to me seems a little more viable than the speech issue and that question, because procedurally, yes. However, we've looked at, and you and I have talked at length on previous shows and just at length anyway, about all of the strings that come attached to federal funding. And this is part of the reason that we have a rise of the bureaucratic state, and we don't really have federalism in the way that the founders intended, because so much federal funding goes to the states with strings attached, and they say if you want this federal funding, here's what you can and can't spend it on, and the states are bound by that. So why would Harvard be any different if President Trump and his administration is basically saying, well, we'll give you these things, but not to spend it on certain types of programs? It should seem that if the federal government is the grantor here, then they can at least dictate what it isn't spent on.
You know, I really appreciate what Donald Trump is trying to do and his administration is trying to do across a broad swath of issues. We've gotten to a place in our country where the federal government is too large. It has moved too far to the left. It has pushed that agenda, and it appears he's trying to move it back. You know, he is a force of nature in and of himself. And what he's finding and is going to continue to find, I think, is that the administrative state and the federal government itself is a force of nature. You know, people may be reading about the whole Pete Hegseth issue and what Caroline Leavitt said yesterday. This is what happens when you have the, quote unquote, entire Department of Defense against you. I mean, he is taking on the administrative state. It is not just going to allow its funding to be taken away, its policies to be taken away. And here's the other thing. I like the speed of movement, the breadth and the substance of the movement. It's messy, and it's going to continue to be messy, whether it's Harvard, whether it's Department of Defense, whether it's USAID. And it's what we need, in my opinion. We've got to start taking some very bold action. And even though this is bold action, let's not forget, we're $36 trillion in debt. We spend $2 trillion a year more than we take in. You know, I was looking at an ex post yesterday that someone put out there about from Peter Thiel, who said what I just said about the $4.5 trillion and $6.2 trillion. And he said, who thinks it's going to be fun to cut $2 trillion of annual spending? That's not easy, but that's what we've got to do. And that's what it looks like when you are trying to take on those kinds of those issues.
And this is exactly what President Trump tried to do in his first term, and why the uniparty and the bureaucratic state was so against him and tried to entangle him with all of the impeachment nonsense, the Russia hoax, I mean, all of these other things to distract and get his attention and the media's attention so much on defending all of those things that he couldn't get the policy wins that he really wanted to and drain the swamp. I mean, that was a big deal, of course, in the 2016 election. And while he's not necessarily framing it that way, heading into this second term, that has always been a top priority for him. And Republicans and Democrats alike, who are used to spending all kinds of money in Washington and then places like Harvard and all that, don't want him to be successful for that. So is he being smart and strategic, though, in freezing this and in the manner that he is, and maybe running afoul of some of those procedural mechanisms? Or is it just a way to say, to basically plant the flag and say, we're going to try to fight this, and then we'll work out the procedural later so that we can at least get some wins?
Well, it sounds like he has a strategy, which is move quickly, move boldly, and we'll figure it out as we go. And frankly, it's probably about the best you can do when you're talking about a $4.5 trillion or $6 trillion government. So I give him a lot of credit for it. And, you know, it's going to be messy, folks. It's not going to be easy. And you know what? He's just scratching the surface, in my opinion. We have so much structural reform to do that, you know, this stuff that, you know, freezing $2 billion of Harvard. I mean, we're $36 trillion in debt, Jenna. We spend $2 trillion a year that we don't have.
It's insane.
That's a problem.
It's, it, Absolutely. And everybody, especially the people who hold themselves out as fiscal conservatives and Republicans, should be a lot more concerned about that. But where is Congress in all this? I mean, I don't see Speaker Johnson, for example, talking about this every day. And then they're passing this massive spending bill, which even a lot of Republicans have said, well, we need for X, Y, and Z reason. But they're not following it up by recognizing what DOGE is doing and then suggesting that in the Budget Committee, appropriations and so forth, that they actually take steps to mitigate some of this based on DOGE's findings. And I was actually this morning, Mike Donnelly, watching a video from Congressman Byron Donalds in Florida, which is still, you know, my home state, which is very conservative. And he's talking about, he gets a question from the audience about DOGE, and the audience seems to be very anti-congressional oversight, or maybe they're thinking Congress should do more, but it's a very tense exchange. And it was very interesting to see that, and in my opinion, you know, Byron Donalds, I think, is a great congressman, but I think he's a little too hesitant to actually jump into issues and confront things head on. Wasn't really that formidable of a presenter in responding to these questions. But that really characterizes Congress, where they're kind of weak. They kind of give the impression like, meh, you know, we'll get around to it at some point. Well, 4 years is going to run out pretty quick.
It is, and Congress has given away so much of its authority. It has abdicated its oversight responsibility. It just does political theater. And if we're going to fix this country, it's going to take a lot more than Congress. It's going to take the states. It's going to take we the people electing people to our state governments, and the state governments are going to have to start pushing back and actually saying to the federal government, no, we're not going to take your money. And to the Harvard issue, you know, with government coin comes government control. And although I think the government may have gotten a little bit over its skis here in terms of the way it has gone after Harvard, you know, we'll see how the courts sort it out. But it's going in the right direction. And, you know, these are, look, President Trump has brought people into his administration who want to get things done and they want to fix problems. So I give them a lot of credit for that. You know, they're not going to do it exactly the right way every time, but they're going in the right direction. And I think we've got to give them a lot of credit, and we've got to be patient. And again, we are spending $2 trillion a year more than we take in. We are on the edge of a cliff. We've got to do something. And so I see him doing something, but it's going to take a lot more than what he's doing.
I'm speaking with Mike Donnelly. You can follow him at Donnelly Speaks on X. He describes himself as constitutionalist and opinionated, which obviously is why we have him on the show. And I want to get your comments and your opinions, Mike, on another headline before we let you go, which is this. And in the midst of the Pope's death yesterday, which dominated the news, it kind of seems like Klaus Schwab sort of flew under the radar here, resigning as the World Economic Forum founder. He retired as the chairman. So this coming from AP. So he's best known for hosting the annual meeting of political, business and other elites in Davos. He's retiring as chairman for more than half a century after creating the Geneva-based think tank. And that's how the AP characterizes it. But he was said in a statement yesterday, he was stepping down with immediate effect. What's going on?
Wow. I did see that he was changing, or somebody else was going to be taking over. He's 87 years old. I mean, I don't know why he's done it so suddenly. I doubt it was that sudden. There's probably been plans for a while, and they just decided to take advantage of this opportunity to fly under the radar. The World Economic Forum is an interesting entity. You and I have talked about globalism and the global elites and the attempt to impose a one world government and how the World Economic Forum has been kind of part of that conversation. You know, Donald Trump certainly is a very strong advocate for national sovereignty. I think that the globalist agenda is going to have a difficult time to move forward. You know, while Donald Trump is president, I think that's a good thing for the people of the world, in my opinion. I mean, I'm for, you know, people being able to trade and interact culturally, but at the same time, you've got to have nation states that protect their borders and protect their people. And so, you know, we need to see who's the next person who's going to step into that role and what their vision is. But I doubt it'll change. Globalism is not going to go away just because Klaus Schwab steps down from being chairman of the WEF.
And according to the AP, former Nestle chairman and CEO Peter Brabeck-Lemaitre, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, was unanimously selected as interim chairman by the forum's board in a special meeting on Sunday, and a search committee has been set up to choose a permanent successor. It'll be interesting to see if, you know, someone like Alex Soros or, you know, other prominent globalists end up taking over the WEF and where exactly that goes. But you're absolutely right that in the midst of Trump pushing America first, this has had an effect on other countries, certainly, you know, Brazil and European countries and others saying, well, we want to be our country first as well and actually enforce our borders, have sovereignty. And that's, of course, very biblical that God establishes nations and boundaries. And we see that in Acts 17 and among other places. And that is the correct view that in America, we should be America first and our government should serve our citizens. And that gets into, of course, the topic of illegal immigration and this push by the Democrats to, I mean, they're all going down to El Salvador now and following that one Democrat idiot congressman who goes and meets with the Trendyaragua gang member.
Holland,
and everybody's
Senator Van Hollen from Maryland. Yeah.
Yes. And who's sitting there across from him suggesting that he's not MS-13. Well, it was either the AP or one of those that's posting this story with a picture of the guy who actually has like the gang member symbols tattooed on his knuckles in the photo. I mean, it's so laughable. But now other Democrats are following suit and they're saying we won't rest until these illegals get due process. And, you know, you and I had talked about this a couple of weeks ago, but mm-hmm. this goes into the whole idea of sovereignty and enforcing our borders and what kind of process is actually due. And so when we've talked about that in the context of the Constitution, but in the context of globalism, that becomes also, I think, an interesting discussion.
It is interesting. And of course, the globalist elites want free movement of people. They don't want there to be borders. And so, you know, Joe Biden bought into that more than any other president in history. We saw numbers of immigrants, illegal aliens coming across the border in numbers that we've never seen before. I think they were record-breaking, issuing Social Security numbers to millions of illegal immigrants. The Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, Haiti program, which we talked about a week or two ago. We do have to enforce our borders. And so I think what the president is doing is right on. He's moving quickly and boldly, which is what needs to happen. He learned from his first term that they're going to try to gum up the works. So you know what? Let's get the gum started quickly, get it through the courts as quickly as we can, and keep moving that policy forward. It can't be true that you can just step across the border and be here for a month or two or three, and then you can't be just immediately sent back when you cross into this country illegally. That should not be true. And so we need to push on that. You know, 11, 15 million illegal aliens have entered this country over the last, 4 years or so. And
yeah,
if you just give them 1 hour each of due process, you've got 11 million hours. How many years is that? I don't know. But it will tax the ability of the federal government to process them, and we'll never send them back, which is probably part of the plan.
Absolutely. That's the point, is to bog them down in process. And Trump even responded to with that that whole idea and saying that it's impossible with the over 11 million that Biden brought in just in the last 4 years to look at those on a case-by-case basis, even if you only spent, you know, 30 seconds, but said, hey, we looked at this individually. It's still really difficult. So Mike Donnelly, we got to take a break here, but always appreciate your thoughts. And this is an ongoing discussion, of course, and hopefully the judiciary will not stymie Trump in his agenda to actually be America first and protect our borders. But we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Will you take take a moment and celebrate life with me? Last year, Preborn helped to rescue over 67,000 babies from abortion. Hi, this is Jenna Ellis, and I want to thank you for your partnership. Think about what you did. 67,000 babies are taking their first breath now because of you. Your $28 sponsored one ultrasound that was given to a woman as she was deciding about the future of her child. Once she saw her precious baby for the first time and heard their sweet heartbeat, her baby's chance at life doubled. But Preborn's mission is not only to rescue babies' lives, but also to lead women to Christ. Last year, Preborn Network clinics saw 8,900 women receive salvation. Your help is crucial to continue their life-saving work. Your caring, tax-deductible donation saves lives, so please be generous. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR, or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Your love can save a life.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, let's turn to the FTC and recent antitrust and tech cases. So President Trump has set out a very ambitious agenda to usher in a new golden age for American innovation. His focus on deregulation and eliminating government waste are noble and necessary endeavors. However, the FTC, or the Federal Trade Commission's leadership, appears to be taking positions on business growth and antitrust law that threaten the Trump agenda. So let's welcome in Patrick Hedger, who is NetChoice Director of policy. So where's the FTC and the Trump administration clashing?
Yeah, so the Trump administration is absolutely right to identify that we need to lead the future of innovation, especially in a race against China. And then nowhere is that more apparent than in artificial intelligence or AI. But unfortunately, what we're seeing is the continuation of a lot of cases that were shaped by the Biden administration going after America's leading AI innovators and investors, which are the major tech companies. And the way they're going about a lot of these cases, forget the impact that they will have on Meta, for example, which is one of the companies that's being sued by the FTC. The precedent that these cases would set would send a chilling effect to markets that would create a lot of uncertainty in the future and harm the ability for these companies to invest and expand AI.
And that really seems problematic on face, because if America isn't involved, as you know, J.D. Vance has recognized in a couple of, I think, brilliant speeches talking about AI, and that America should be at the forefront of this because we need to have at least some contours and regulation that are good, but not to overly regulate it, which is always the problem and the balance. But if America is just burdened by all of this litigation, then other countries like China will continue to expand and be so far ahead of the game that it'll be very difficult for America to catch up.
Yeah, and I understand the impetus behind a lot of this, the angst against technology companies, but I think a lot of that is misplaced. I mean, we saw evidence that a lot of what was happening was pressure coming from the federal government to take down and silence people. Continuing to pursue the tech companies when they are really sort of at the forefront and on the front lines of making those necessary investments in creating AI technology and quantum computing, for example, another technology that was going to be really important in the future, especially as if for defense applications as well, I think is a big mistake. I think the president is absolutely right to be laser focused on creating a golden age through AI investments. The second day he was in office, he took time to talk about the importance of data centers for AI through the Stargate announcement, talking about, half a trillion dollars in new investment coming into the United States with just that one project alone. But these cases we're seeing at FTC and DOJ would cause companies to pause that type of investment. Because if you look at the FTC's case against Meta, they're trying to unwind mergers that they made, acquisitions that they made over a decade ago. And that's a pretty bad signal to investors.
And what's the purpose of the FTC trying to go after Meta in that way? I mean, if this has been a decade in the making, why are they just now targeting Meta?
Yeah, that's a good question. And these were acquisitions, WhatsApp and Instagram, that were acquired by Meta over a decade ago that the FTC said at the time that they weren't going to take action on. So they essentially blessed these mergers, and now the company is in sort of an effective double jeopardy, if you will. What they're trying to say is that Meta monopolized the friends and family social media marketplace, but on its face, I think most people understand that they face competition from TikTok. They face competition from X. We've recently seen that Meta, Facebook, has changed its content moderation to do more community notes, just like Elon Musk's X. And so that shows that the market is still really dynamic. And I just think that this kind of antitrust intervention is not warranted and is probably going to do a lot more harm than good.
Yeah, and so what would be the Trump administration's potential avenues to respond to this, and especially in light of this January 23rd presidential action statement that's literally titled Removing Barriers to American Leadership in Artificial Intelligence, and clearly the administration wants to be at the forefront of this. Should the FTC be able to step in and slow that down?
Yeah, I think the Trump administration really, at any time, increasingly can... is saying that the FTC is not so much an independent agency, but is an agency that should be responsive to the executive. And, this is something that the Trump administration has said, that, we're going to start reining in so-called independent agencies. And so the Trump administration really at any time could say, hey, let's settle these cases. Let's move on, because we've got a lot bigger fish to fry. And that fish is certainly China's entry into the AI marketplace, and also quantum computing, robotics, driverless cars, drones, things like that. All of these are really important technologies where the Chinese are either nipping at our heels in AI or actually are ahead of us in terms of robotics.
And I'm speaking with Patrick Hedger, who is the NetChoice Director of Policy. And if the Trump administration seeks to dictate to the FTC how to settle, for example, this case against Meta, is that going to create a potential clash, like the litigation that's suggesting that Trump, for example, can't fire certain executive office holders or agents, and sort of set up whether or not these agencies can act independently, or whether they are submissive and responsible overall to the chief executive?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. That all does come down to, what the Supreme Court is going to say about Humphrey's executor. That is the overriding precedent on this issue of independent agencies. But we've increasingly seen that the FTC has branded itself as the Trump-Vance FTC. And so I think they would be responsive to a call from the White House if the White House said, hey, look, these cases are holding back some of our other objectives here, which again is greater investment in AI. And that investment is not just in software, it's in a lot of hardware as well. You talk about what powers AI, it is data centers. And these are buildings that are filled with servers, and they take a lot of steel and they take a lot of concrete and create a lot of jobs in the process of producing them, and a lot of investment in communities. So there's a lot riding here on these cases.
And so if the FTC is framing it as the Trump-Vance FTC, so to align with President Trump's vision that he's outlined for this golden age of innovation, what should they do at this point, and even before necessarily being ordered to by the administration?
Yeah, I think increasingly the cases are looking flimsy, and you're wasting taxpayer resources in pursuing sort of an uncertain end. It's also creating, again, the deterrent effect towards investment and innovation that we've been talking about. So it would be good to start looking for off-ramps, start looking for acceptable settlements in order to kind of let these unleash these companies in order to be able to do the kind of investment and innovation that we need to kind of fulfill the Trump administration's agenda on AI.
And how does this also reconcile with Trump's previous digital bill of rights that his campaign put out, which we haven't heard a whole lot about? I mean, but there's been obviously a lot of other things going on in the last couple of months.
Yeah, so the Trump administration has been great about saying, hey, we're going to put an end to what we saw in the federal government in terms of putting pressure on companies to silence speech. And I think that's really the nexus of the problem that we saw. And I think the administration would be wise to begin working with Congress to codify those things so that when the Trump administration is no longer in power, we don't just have a Democratic president reinstitute all those policies and scrap what the Trump administration is trying to do. We need to put some permanency to these things by codifying them. Senator Rand Paul has a bill that would do that. So I think that would be a good next step.
Yeah. Well, again, with so many other things, it all depends on Congress, and Congress doesn't seem to be moving nearly as quickly as President Trump and his administration and with the mandate that the American people provided. But Patrick Hedger, really appreciate your time this morning. He's the NetChoice Director of Policy. You can follow NetChoice on X at NetChoice. And before we run out of time this morning, I want to welcome in Chelsea Wildman, who is the Associate Director of the AFA Foundation, to talk a little bit more about the foundation and its goals. So good morning, Chelsea.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Jenna.
Tell us, for those who haven't heard or maybe have heard a little bit about the AFA Foundation, what this is and why this is so important to our ministry and organization.
Yes. So our foundation, we seek to exist to help individuals leave a lasting legacy to pass on to the next generation, to sow seeds into our ministry while also helping them in their retirement years. So the main way that we do that is our charitable gift annuity, and that allows someone to give a gift and then receive a lifetime income in return. And that also has some wonderful tax benefits. So that is the main way that we help folks leave a lasting legacy with AFA and with the kingdom.
And this is a really great way to give. We just came off of Share-a-thon week, and those are always such special weeks and in my view, and I always love being able to participate in that. And so many of our regular donors give a monthly gift, but this is a way that you can plan a little bit more through the AFA Foundation. So what is the contrast between if someone's saying, well, I already give monthly, then why should I be part of the foundation?
Yes. So giving monthly, they get an outright tax donation, which is great. But through the charitable gift annuity, they are giving into the ministry through a one-time larger gift. The minimum is $2,000 or more. So a gift of $2,000 or more gives you a lifetime income with some tax benefits. You get a tax deduction the year that you put the gift in place, as well as partial tax-free income when those payments start coming to you in your retirement years. And then once you pass away and go home to be with the Lord, any remaining funds are then gifted to AFA to continue our ministry's work for the Lord. So definitely wonderful to be a monthly donor, a yearly donor, but this is separate in that you are, we like to say, possibly leaving, you know, your final tithe, because the work is, your funds are going to the work of the Lord.
And you can find out more at afafoundation.net. That's afafoundation.net. And there are a lot more information about how to give, what to give, and also some donor stories. So in just the last few minutes I have with you, Chelsea, what are some donor stories that stand out in your mind of why people are choosing to give through the foundation and the blessings that they talk about in terms of helping this ministry?
Yes. So we have so many donors that will give so that our ministry's legacy can continue for their children and their grandchildren. We hear so many you know, donors that really have a passion for AFA and the work that we are doing. And so to pinpoint one is so very hard, but so many just love the work that AFA and AFR are doing in reaching the lost for Christ, and also, you know, our political stance as well. And so, yes, so many blessings that have come from all of our donors. And actually, that leads me into our Weekend with AFA event, where we actually get to meet with our supporters and with our friends from across the country. And that event is coming up October 2nd through the 4th at Kingfisher Lodge in Tupelo. So this is a yearly, this is the first time that we've had it in Tupelo, but we wanted to give folks a chance to see, you know, where the boots on the ground are in Tupelo, see our headquarters, take a tour, and then also, you know, go away mm-hmm. for some time of retreat and relaxing and refreshing, hearing from some of our speakers and meeting some of our AFR hosts. So the Weekend with AFA is going to be a wonderful way to do that.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Chelsea. And again, you can go to afafoundation.net. You can read the donor stories there talking about why people have become donors to the American Family Association to continue in the direction of serving Christ and standing up for biblical principles. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna@afr.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.